Welcome to Out of School, a podcast at the intersection of technology and education. My name is Bradley Chambers, and my special guest tonight from a country that we've never talked to before. Before we meet our guest, let's thank our sponsors for the night. The first is Jamf Software. You guys know Jamf. They provide IT staff with enterprise tools that power widespread use of Apple technologies, such as Macs, iPads, iPhones, and Apple TVs in schools. Learn more about them at jampsoftware.com. Next, it's by Shobi. They are the iPad app for paperless classrooms. They make it easy to assign, collect, and review student work, and then provide rich feedback to students with annotations, voice notes, and more. And finally, we're sponsored by Aerohive, makers of great cloud-managed, controlless Wi-Fi. Aerohive technology enables organizations of all sizes to use mobility to increase productivity, engage customers, and grow their businesses. You can learn more about them at aerohive.com. So Fraser is off this week. It's funny, Josh. The inside joke about a school is that I can never pronounce Fraser right. And so there's a friend of the show, Fraser Hess. He always will rib us on iMessage. Like, anytime I pronounce it wrong, I'll always hear about it on Monday or Tuesday when we release the show. He'll say something like, "Hey, Bradley, actually pronounced your name right this week," and it'll be a group message. So I always pronounce Fraser's name wrong. It's just Southern draw here in the U.S. I blame it on that. Fraser is off this week, but I have a special guest. Is Josh Robb from the American School in Japan. So welcome, Josh.
Thanks.
So Josh and I never talked to Josh actually until earlier this week, and I mentioned to you on the show a few months ago that I'm doing some freelance work for Kirby, and I've got a I'll hopefully have a cool announcement about them here in a few weeks. Something, a cool project we're working on together. But Josh's school uses Kirby, and so we were emailing back and forth about a question. And so when I heard the title of his school name, I thought, like, I've got to have him on the show. So Josh, tell us about yourself and where you work.
Sure. Okay. So yeah, I work at the American School in Japan. I'm the manager of IT services there. I've been there about 10 years, and so it's been a long, long time. I've actually been in Japan about 14 years, and so as you can tell, I'm not Japanese. Well, I don't know if you can tell, but I'm not Japanese. I grew up in Minnesota, actually, before venturing to Japan. And so the school, it's an international school, and for the listeners who maybe it's the first time they've heard of international schools, there are a ton of schools around the world that follow either the American sort of curriculum, or a lot of them are international baccalaureate IB schools, and they serve very interesting clientele, but most often it's expats from different countries. So Americans, but also Europeans, it's sometimes people from, in fact, there's an international school in Minnesota that serves Korean students. They actually, the Korean students in Minnesota go to a Korean school in Minnesota. I had a friend who worked there a while back. But my school, the American School in Japan, we're in Tokyo. We have about 1,500 students. We're pre-K all the way through 12. And I believe we have almost 40 different nationalities. And so it's a very, you know, multicultural school. But the thing is that it's all in English, and we follow an American curriculum. And so you are living in Japan, and when you walk in the front doors of our school, it feels like you're walking into America. I mean, the cafeteria is an American-type cafeteria. It's a very interesting experience. I'm used to it at this point, but it's one of those things when people first come, they're kind of like, this is strange.
Well, it almost suspends belief. You walk in there and you're like, wait, am I back in America? Like, that concept is kind of hard to wrap my head around, that there would be enough demand in Japan for an American school. I mean, again, I'm not from, you know, Chattanooga is a city, but it's not a big city. I'm from Chattanooga, Tennessee. And so, like, it would kind of blow my mind that there would be, say, demand enough here for, say, the Japan school in America. So, like, how is there enough demand, I guess, and, you know, distance-wise, like, where there's enough people that want to go there?
Well, it's actually, we are one of a handful of international schools in Tokyo alone. I believe there are, just for English-speaking international schools, there are at least 10, I shouldn't say that for sure, but it's around 10, and then there are also a German school, a British school as well. And so the demand is actually high. Most of the clientele are people who get transferred here for their job, and say you're working for the U.S. Embassy and you come to Japan for 2 years. Well, you could put your child in a Japanese school, but they don't speak Japanese, the curriculum is different, and you know you'll be going back in 2 years. And so they would send their children to our school where they can continue, you know, their education for the 2 years they're here and then go back. So that's one example. There are, you know, people who work for large banks, Goldman Sachs, those types of places. They send their kids to our school. And sometimes it's even, you know, locals who want their kids to have an American sort of education. There is a very, very wide variety and a lot of different stories for our clientele. But the interesting thing is that there's a high demand, and we're not the only school, even just in Tokyo.
Yeah, that concept just blows my mind. Of course, you may not know the exact numbers. You mentioned like kids coming over for 2 years with their parents' job. Like, do you see a lot of kids finish, like start at pre-K and then finish in 12th grade? Or do you see kids that kind of, not a revolving door admissions-wise, but do you see a lot of people that come for kind of a stopgap stay?
Well, you know, it's funny. It's kind of in between. You see both. And what you get used to when working in an international school is that kids do leave more often than, say, at a public school in the States. You know, kids, you know, come and go. And it kind of becomes part of the culture where the kids get very, very used to making friends quickly and then learning how to say goodbye to those friends. But it's a different world than when we were kids. You know, these kids go off to another school and they're still on Twitter and Facebook with each other. They're still iMessaging. So it's a funny sort of thing where they don't quite lose contact. So I would say there are kids who stay, you know, pre-K all the way through 12. But I would say most kids, you know, would stay a handful of years, longer than two usually. But I would say a lot of them would stay, you know, maybe 6-7 years, that sort of length.
Before we move on, let's thank our first sponsor of the night. It's Jamp Software. They provide IT staff with enterprise tools that power widespread use of Apple technologies, such as Macs, iPads, iPhones, and Apple TVs in education organizations. Now with Casper Focus, they place these great technologies directly in the hands of teachers who work with students every day. Casper Focus allows teachers to quickly gain students' attention, conduct secure exams within an app, select a specific Apple TV assigned to their classroom, choose and distribute iBooks, and even initiate AirPlay right from within Casper Focus. If you want to learn more about Jamp Software, go to outofschool.net. This is episode 131. They have a special URL for you to use to visit their website. Thanks to Jamp for sponsoring the show this week. You know, it's interesting you say that about keeping in contact, because I literally have never thought about that. That, you know, I remember growing up, kids would like, you know, move in, they would you know, go to school, and they would move for whatever reason, and you literally would never see them again.
Yep.
And now it's like, yeah, we maybe not see each other at school, but there are a lot of kids you didn't see at school every day, especially if you go to a decent sized school. So you can keep up on Facebook, on Twitter, on Snapchat, or whatever the trendy service is. And, you know, of course, that's an interesting concept in itself. Like, what social networks are popular in what countries among what age groups? Because I guess before I got into education, I used to not think about that. And I would think whatever I was into was what was popular. And now, like, you know, some of our students are old enough where they're starting to venture onto social networks, and the ones they use are like, you know, like they're not into Twitter. Like, Twitter is not their thing, but like for me, Twitter is the social network. And then, you know, Facebook's not even popular for them. It's things like Snapchat, which, right, I think Facebook even on. So I guess maybe they're technically on Facebook. You know, Snapchat and Instagram. Right. Yeah, it's just, you know, so from an admissions process, like how does that? I guess. Is it they're basically constantly having to be bringing in new students if they know, hey, we see like X percent of people that stay 5 years and they leave. Like, you've got to constantly be kind of getting people, you know, new ones in.
Right. It's very interesting that for the most part, it still tends to follow the school year. I will say we are an American curriculum, and we do follow the American schedule. So we start end of August. We're done at the beginning of June. I mean, we're right now, we're wrestling over Common Core. I mean, you know, we're very, very American. So when people send their employees over to Tokyo, they tend to send them in the summer around that time, and they kind of plan the transition so that the kids can start school. But we also do have a larger uptake in the middle of the year, like around December, and then we have another one a little bit in the spring. And so we do constantly have a stream, but I would say majority still follow, you know, starting in August, starting in September, and finishing the whole school year. So, and in fact, sometimes you'll have a thing where, say, one of the parents gets transferred to Hong Kong or back to the States or somewhere else, that maybe the other parent may stay with the kids to finish out the school year if there's just a couple months left. So it is a very, you know, I'm saying this out loud now, and it's funny because to me it's so normal. And as I'm saying it to you, I'm realizing, yeah, this is very different.
Well, yeah, because, I don't know, yeah, it is somewhere where you – where we assume that we have students that come in our 3-year-old kindergarten and will stay for 3-year-old kindergarten, 4-year-old kindergarten, and then we'll lose a certain set of students going to public school after that. You know, a lot of people will use our pre-K as basically a better educated daycare,
right?
If that makes sense. Like, it's like we need childcare for work, and we are honestly just, we are cheaper than daycare in a lot of situations, and it's a structured curriculum. It's not just basically people watching your kids.
Right.
And so, but we, you know, can we kind of assume once we get them into K-5 for our 5-year-old kindergarten, the ones that are there, like, our hope is that they finish, and we're sad when they don't. But for you guys, and of course we have people that move, and you just kind of like accept that, and you don't worry about that from like a student retention standpoint, because there's nothing, you know, you can't do anything about that. And so you probably, a lot of your students are, well, we really enjoyed your time here, but we understand that your family is moving, so have a nice life, kind of situation, where you're not upset that they're leaving, because there's nothing you could have done to save them. And we think this is the time of year when we think about things like that a lot, when you have, you know, family not coming back. It's like, what could we have done anything to save this family? And right. What we find in most situations for us, there was nothing we could have done. You know, they were, yeah, since we stop at fifth grade, let's say they have an older sibling. So when they leave, like if they have an older sibling graduated, occasionally they'll go ahead and pull the younger one and move them to the next school. That maybe it's a K-12, and or we'll have people that they just move, and it's sad, but there's nothing you can do. I mean, there's, you know, nothing you can do to save them.
Right. Well, we are a little bit different in that for us, we have those same concerns, but it's actually the competition for the other international schools in Tokyo that we have to kind of look at. And, you know, one thing I will say is that, you know, our school is it's a popular school. We've been around since 1902, you know, so it's been in Japan a long time. And we have families that, you know, a parent may get transferred away, and then they will actually petition their company to get transferred back to Tokyo so they can come back to our school. So it is a funny thing. You would think, yeah, it's sort of out of our hands, but if we do a good job and have a quality education, it does inform some of our parents who have the option to say, hey, you know, I really want to be posted back in Tokyo because I would like my kids to go back to that school. So even though it seems like a different scale because people are traveling and moving around the world, it's very similar to the same sorts of concerns you would have at a school like yours.
It blows my mind. It really blows my mind. And so, you know, you mentioned the competition with the other schools. Like, what's the admissions process like? It's like, you know, someone, you know, they're planning on moving to Tokyo, for example. Do they come in and tour the schools, like, you know, before they move, and tour a bunch of schools? Or do they, once they come in for, say, a tour of your school, are they pretty certain that they're going to come? Like, what is that process like, especially sure. since people, everybody generally is kind of moving in?
Right. Well, you know, it really depends on the different clientele. You know, there are people who are local already, and they would do admissions like they would do, say, at your school. Check the website. We have online applications. We have an admissions office. They can come in. They can call. For the people coming from other countries, most often what happens is it's part of their relocation service. The company will say, you're going to move to Tokyo. All right, here's the things we're going to have to help you figure out. How do you move all your, you know, all your things? How do you find a place to live? What school to go to? And there are actually relocation companies that will help them decide on a school. Maybe bring them to a few different schools, you know, and they can come and they take tours at our school. And that is happening all year round. There are definitely, you know, peak times, but we are always getting people visiting and checking out the school. It's whenever the company says, okay, we're going to fly you over, you know, a few months early just so you can check out where you're going to be working, where you're going to be living, things like that. And so you do get some of that. We did move to online admissions a few years ago, so we do actually see people who, before they're even coming, starting the application process while they're still, say, in the States or, you know, in Europe or somewhere else. So we get a kind of both sort of situations, but it is it what happens is our admissions office is always just cranking along, giving tours. They hold different sessions throughout the year. They're accepting applications all year round. So it is very important that our admissions office is constantly being ready for new families.
So I guess in some ways you kind of have to stay buddy up with these relocation companies.
A little bit, but it's also, you know, one of the things that I've seen a shift in the past number of years is because now we all have the information online. We have online admissions. You know, people can actually go and search out the information about the different schools. You know, you think back to 15, 20 years ago, you would be dependent on the relocation companies to find out, well, what schools even exist in Tokyo. Whereas now you can do a search for Tokyo International School and you'll get a list of every single one and you can do your own research. So it is one of those things where, you know, we are on the list for a lot of the relocation companies, so that is good. But it's also more of just, you know, as I said before, doing our best to have the highest quality education we can, and you know, people can find that information for themselves if they want to.
Yeah, we've seen that as well in our admissions process. Like parents or potential parents are much more informed about your school mm-hmm. on the front end. You know, they have generally, maybe if they know someone, and then they've scoured your website, looked at every page, you have tons of questions. It does seem like the parents in 2015 are in some ways just a lot more well-informed about what your school does, its history, and you know, things like that, which, you know, obviously that's great because that helps people find out on their own as well as they're searching. Before we move on, let's thank our second sponsor of the night. It's the fine folks at Aerohive Networks. Aerohive unleashes the power of enterprise mobility. Aerohive's technology enables organizations of all sizes to use mobility to increase productivity, engage customers, and grow their businesses. Aerohive's proprietary mobility platform takes advantage of the cloud and a distributed architecture to deliver unified, intelligent, simplified, and cost-effective networks. Learn more about Aerohive Networks at aerohive.com. That's AEROHIVE.com.
We actually use Aerohive as well, and it was a funny thing the other day. Our vendor for Aerohive, who's Japanese, you know, came to our school, and he was just, you know, walking around, and he's just blown away, you know, like looking at. He's like, "I'm in America right now. This is just crazy," you know, like he just couldn't believe it. And I was said, "Yeah, that's the way your school is," you know.
Well, you know, it's funny, like you. And that obviously shows how things have just changed over the say the past, you know, 15, 20 years, in that like these technology solutions are no longer like localized in a lot of way. Like it's very much you're always buying from global companies, and yep. So we're all buying really the same technology. We have sent the access to the same technology, and it comes down to like we're using the same distributor, but you're just using a different value added reseller.
Right. Exactly.
So that was actually my next question. Like how is your network set up? I mean, what's your incoming bandwidth coming in? What do you use for Wi-Fi? How is your network laid out?
Sure. The one thing that's awesome about Tokyo is our network speeds are insanely fast. Whenever I listen to podcasts in the state and people are complaining about uploads and downloads, I'm just smiling because, in Tokyo, basically everybody has fiber to their house or to their business. It's common to have at least 200 megabits up and 200 down, but I would say at this point there's a big push to go gigabit. So my house right now, I'm on a gigabit up, gigabit down fiber connection, and it's basically everybody in this neighborhood is the same. And our school, we actually trunk two different fiber lines from two different ISPs. And so we're right now, We're getting 300 megabits per second down and about 300 up. We haven't moved to the gigabit yet because we haven't quite needed it, but also because our vendor has sort of said, all the people in your neighborhood are jumping the gigabit, so wait till that kind of calms down. We build up the infrastructure, and then we'll move you over to gigabit as well. So it's very nice that we can depend on consistently fast internet that never goes down. I think in the 14 years I've lived here, we've had maybe one or two interruptions that were very, very brief, and that's it.
Well, yeah, we're in the same boat, and I don't know that, and that's something. I actually had a call from a professor at our local university last week. They were doing some research on basically the financial impact for schools. In terms of like what does incredibly fast internet do for you, and that's something I was trying to get across to him. It's like it's not because we don't even have the gigabit that our ISP offers. We have 400 up and 400 down, and to me it's like it's not the number of the gigabit, because there's a lot of services that you use that just gigabit doesn't help you, and they can't take advantage of it. But it's almost like you get to a point where it's so fast, it just doesn't matter what you have, because it is so fast and so reliable, it just doesn't matter, and it just works. And we've probably had less than five outages since I've been at Brainerd. So that's five outages in 6 years. Most of those have been like power being out.
Right.
Or we had one where a telephone pole fell on our fiber line.
Oh, jeez.
And pulled it clean out of the building. It literally took them a day to get it back up.
Oh, that's terrible.
Because they had to get the fiber. Our fiber is fairly deep in the building, our ONT. So it took them a day to get it back up. And then last week, I guess it was last Wednesday, I get up and I notice like my internet at home is a little flaky. And so then I start at about 7:30. I start getting text messages like, "Hey, the internet seems to be flaky at work." And so I log in to what it was. First thing I always do is I log into Hive Manager. Now, I don't know if that's what you do. That's always telltale sign from home is if the network's up. And so like Hive Manager has like half the APs up. I'm like, okay, that's odd. Well, then I try to log into my firewall remotely and I can't. So I know it's like kind of slowly going down.
Right.
But I also know that's an ISP issue, because if like half my APs are still up, when I say up, I mean they could talk to Hive Manager, which doesn't mean that they're not working. If they can't, it just means they couldn't get to Hive Manager. And so I called my ISP. And it was a long hold time, so I knew that they were having an issue. It's funny that a buddy of mine answered the phone. That's what seemed about having a local ISP is like he calls. I'm like, oh hey Matt, how's it going? Look, and he tells me the issue. Says they're working on it, but like you just kind of like, and it happens so infrequently. Like you're kind of like, well that's fine. You guys take your time getting it fixed.
Right.
Of course, the funny thing about it was that was testing week for us, and we don't do online exams. Yet, just because the software for a lot of that here in the States is just horrendous. Like there are schools around us that have gone digital and have gone back, and I'm so cautious on things like that because, yeah, it would be great to be digital. It would make it easier, but you got to have it working, and we know pencils work.
Right.
And I even said to them like, yeah, aren't you glad we're not doing digital exams right now? That I'd be sweating a lot more. And of course, they had it up really bright when school started. They had it back up. But you just, gosh, it is terrifying in a way to make that jump, because once you go, you really kind of can't go back.
Oh, exactly. And that's the thing, is your expectation from your user base is that you're going to have this high-quality internet all the time. And if it goes down, you find out very fast how dependent you are on it. And so we are lucky that it doesn't happen very often. But we also, we live in Tokyo, which is an earthquake zone. And so what we've done is we've taken advantage of our fast internet and have aggressively moved almost everything off-site. So all of our services, we try to do, cloud-based, stuff as much as we can. Which is great, and it helps us for our earthquake preparedness. If we have to, close school or something happens, we can still get to services even if you're not on campus. But the problem is that then the bottleneck becomes the network itself. If the network to the school is not working, well, then pretty much all of our services are offline.
Yeah, that's the same exact way we are. It's great from a disaster recovery standpoint, but when your ISP goes down and you're on campus, it's like, yeah, you can do the things you have locally, but the most things you have aren't local.
Right.
And we've kicked around the idea of having a redundant ISP, but from a budget standpoint, like we would use it so infrequently.
Yeah.
And the thing that we looked into is where in the building that the backup ISP was coming in, they were going to be coming off the same telephone pole that our current one is.
Yep.
And so it's kind of like what, you know, so if a telephone pole hits, both of them are going down. And so like you're going to pay X number of dollars per month, every month, for the 1 or 2 hours a year that your ISP goes down.
Yeah, exactly.
Is it really worth it? Because a lot of things that we do as well that are like our school hosted services are IP locked. So like they have to be on. So it's like trying to make sure that they're on campus doing it. And so it's like you would have to go in and change all that stuff. By the time you get all that changed to the new IP address, it would be like coming back up anyways. So you guys use Aerohive Wi-Fi. What APs do you use?
We have the 121s. When we started going to Aerohive about 2.5 years ago, they were actually, I think, the only ones that were actually ratified to work in Japan at the time. So that was about our only option. But we're actually pretty happy with them. We've been talking, in fact, the vendor that came in last week, you know, we're kind of looking at the 130s and debating, we have a new building going up. Should we put the 130s? Should we stick with the 121s for now and do a full refresh later? But mostly 121s, a few 141s in some, you know, key areas. But we've tried to do, you know, one of their more high density style setups where you have multiple APs in a room. And it's been working pretty great.
Yeah, the 121 is kind of just a workhorse AP. It's not the fastest AP, they say, obviously, but it's very, very low cost, and it really, really just works, especially, you know, depending on what kind of devices you're putting in. You may not even have the devices to take advantage of one of those three-stream access points.
Yeah, exactly. When we have a one-to-one program, and so in the elementary school, it's one-to-one iPads until fifth grade. So from K and first grade, they use school iPads, and then from second to fifth, they bring their own iPad in. And so, you know, up until recently, you know, those radios couldn't take advantage of you know, multiple streams anyway.
Well, it was funny, you know. So after we talked about the Apple Watch last week, and I did some Wi-Fi testing as well. It's like wonder what kind of Wi-Fi card that is. It's like that has to be a single stream Wi-Fi card. And it is kind of crazy that it doesn't seem to be a very strong card, because when I'm in places without my phone and places that, like, I do maybe not have full bars of Wi-Fi, you can see that the Apple Watch is struggling to kind of takes a second longer to pull up your email and things like
right.
that.
Right. Right.
You know, one of the things that I don't think users totally get is how much the client device determines what happens. Like, there's only so much that the radio can do. You know, like if we've seen that with like guests who bring in like junky Android tablets, they just don't roam well and they struggle getting on the Wi-Fi. And they're like, well, you know, what's wrong with your Wi-Fi? It's like, you got a crappy device. Sorry. It's, I don't know what to tell you. And it's like, they're just not used to hearing, basically, because, you know, devices are different. They react differently. They roam differently. And there's nothing that the APs can do about that.
Exactly.
So you mentioned your 1-to-1 iPad, K through 5. What about 6 through 12?
1-to-1 MacBooks, or MacBook Pros, or some sort of Apple laptop. And so we actually, the students have to bring their own as well, but it has to be a Mac. So it's we give some guidelines in terms of, you know, not, you know, a Mac at least this old, but we're pretty relaxed and say, as long as it's a Mac and it's a laptop, you know, bring it in and we'll make it work.
Well, in a lot of situations, it's like if it can run a modern version of Google Chrome, you're generally going to be fine if a lot of the things you do are web-based.
Exactly.
So from a management perspective, I guess you don't really enroll those devices in any sort of management system since they are student-owned.
That's right. And what part of the reason that we had to kind of go this direction is because we have people coming from all different countries, and because we have people coming in and out of the school, it actually just made the most sense to say, you know, you need to bring your own in, and here's the minimum spec. And, you know, for example, when we were looking at the iPad program, you know, there's volume purchasing. There, we looked at MDMs. I talked to Jamf. Those are great guys. You know, I was visiting them in Minnesota a few years back. And in the end, what it comes down to, though, is we have a family from the States, a family from Japan, a family from, you know, France, Germany, and trying to figure out, okay, well, how do we try to manage which stores we get apps from? And the Japanese, you know, iTunes store might not have exactly the same apps, you know, as you'd have in the States. And so looking at all of that and looking at what makes the most sense, in the end, it's like, you know, if the parents can bring in their own app, or sorry, their own iPad, and they can sort of manage it themselves, then they can make sure they get the apps from their home country that makes the most sense on the iPad. And the same thing for the MacBooks, trying to manage all of that. Just in the end, it made sense to offload it to parents. And then what we've done is we've said, okay, we are going to, as a tech department, change our sort of focus and the work we do on the back end, where we would have, you know, enrolled devices and managed them and put that out front and made very visible out front help desks that students and parents can come in to get help on configuring the devices themselves and setting them up themselves. But it does pose some interesting challenges with, say, our network. We don't require them to register their laptops with our network. So our network is very open in terms of who can connect to it, which is very different from a lot of schools.
Yeah, I mean, but in your situation, I see where you guys would make that decision because of your model, and that you do have students that will come for a handful of years and they might leave for jobs. It kind of just eases the turnover, and it's just almost a part of the requirement to coming to school.
Yeah, exactly.
And you're not constantly having to kind of like refresh devices internally.
Exactly. And I think one of the things that it's really, it's interesting because even now we'll have vendors that come in and I'll meet with them and they'll say, okay, so, you know, what kind of, you know, do you have an Open Directory server, an LDAP server? And I'm like, nope. And they're like, well, okay, how do you authenticate users to the network? And I'm like, we don't. And they say, well, who can connect to your network? And I said, anybody who can see the radio. And they're just like, well, we don't understand, because, you know, they're used to corporate, they're used to, you know, highly regulated public schools in Japan or other places, and they just look at us like we're crazy. And we say, well, you know, I know it's different. We do, you know, run the risk of, say, having somebody wander on campus and connect without us knowing, but it's not a huge issue. We're in an area where we don't have a lot of bleed over outside of campus. And then what we do is we really make sure we have a good digital citizenship program in place. So we're working with kids all the time, and they know what's acceptable use on the network, you know, and teachers are very proactive about working with those sorts of issues. But people, just their jaw drops when they hear that, wait, this is how you're managing your network?
Yeah, I mean, because digital citizenship is a culture thing. And it's like kids understanding that these are the devices my parents have purchased, so they really need to take care of them. Yep. And then when it's constantly being reinforced, that you kind of don't have to worry about that. Yeah, and of course we're the same way, but I totally get why some schools are a lot more stringent in how they do authentication. It really just depends on your setup. Like, it just, yeah, you have to do what makes sense for your setup and for your culture and for the type of IT department you want to run. So before we move on, let's thank our final sponsor of the night. It's the fine folks at Shobi. Now, Shobi is an iPad app for paperless classrooms. With Shobi, teachers can quickly and easily assign, collect, and review student work on their iPads, and then provide rich feedback to students by adding annotations, text notes, voice notes, directly onto documents. Students can show their learning creatively by submitting to Shobi from thousands of compatible iPad apps or by completing assignments with Shobi's built-in tools. Shobi keeps everyone organized with individual student assignment folders, email, and push notifications. Now, Shobi Basic is 100% free, and teachers can try it out with their students in their classroom in just a few minutes. You can search for Shobi on the App Store. It's Shobie.com. And they also have a special deal for Shobi Pro for podcast listeners. If you go to Shobi.com/out of school, and we'll have a link to that in the show notes at outofschool.net, if you buy Shobi Pro for 5-year teachers, they'll give you an extra 5 for free for a full year. So that's buy Shobi Pro for 5 teachers and get total of 10 for all their students for a full year. So thanks to Shelby for sponsoring the show this week. So yeah, that's the thing that we're always telling our story. That's the thing I kind of always mention, is that we are kind of simple when it comes to that aspect. But to me, it is, trying to think of the best term, it's making the network where it's easily accessible by all. And it's not like I'm trying to be the gatekeeper to, you know, getting on the internet. Because to me, the internet, we don't view the network resources like we'd say did 15 years ago, where it's like this precious commodity. It's like, we get tons of bandwidth, so everybody hop on and do their thing.
Yeah, exactly. And we, you know, we still have, you know, parents coming in because obviously we always are having new families who kind of look at us and say, well, you know, what's going on here? And I don't know, am I comfortable having my kid, you know, in this sort of environment? But it's a very good conversation to have, because one of the things that we say is, well, when they go home, when they go to Starbucks down the road, when they go somewhere out in the world, they're, you know, they're on an unfiltered network, they're on an open network, they're on there with who knows who, and we would much rather have the ability to work with students in that environment where when they make mistakes, we are aware of them and we can help them learn from them at an early age, rather than saying, nope, only certain people are on our network, we have things so locked down, you have to ask us for permission. Then, you know, they're at home, you know, in the middle of the night posting YouTube to video, and we have no idea. I'd rather have them post that video in an account that we know about at school, that we can just sit down and say, hey, let's have that conversation about, you know, the decision you just made, and let's help you make a better one. And once parents start hearing that, they start saying, you know, that's a good point. You know, like I don't really filter them at home. I don't really am aware of what they're doing at home. And so, you know, once you start to get that buy-in and they start to see the whole picture with the digital citizenship program, it really, the value of it, I think, is obvious. But the first reaction is usually, well, wait a minute, you're doing things very different than what I'm used to.
Yeah, especially if a parent works in the banking industry, they're used to, you know, lockdown security. But I guess that's where, you know, when you pair like these honest conversations about use of the internet at home with a service like Kirby, which I know you guys like, it's, yeah, you know, it's about giving parents the like information to what their, yes, kids are doing and helping to manage that. And it's not treating it like, you know, just straight up rules, but also just really trying to discuss boundaries and like what's appropriate online. Because you know, especially if you've got kids in high school, here in just a few years, they're going to be on an unfiltered world.
Yeah,
and so exactly. you want them to be able to manage that.
And I think that's the thing with Kirby. We sort of say, this is your, you know, in some ways a safety net. You know, we are more concerned about, you know, students stumbling on something inadvertently before they're ready. And so that helps you with that safety net aspect. And then, you know, the fact that it does sort of log where they've been in the apps, it's a place for a conversation, you know. And I love the fact that parents can see it on their own iPad or their iPhone and just get a quick, you know, snapshot of, this is sort of what my child's been doing. And it's not even so much about catching them doing bad things. It's like, wow, I see you spent a lot of time on Facebook. You know, let's talk about that. Is that really the best use of your time? And those sorts of conversations.
Oh yeah, I totally agree that it's, you want to explain to them why they need to tone down their use of technology or social media in order not to impact study time, or just to be, you know, get out and experience the real world. That, like, let's understand why and let's talk about that, rather than just like, okay, 8:30 the internet goes off.
Yeah, and one of the things I think that's different with our school as well, I don't know if it's different, but you know, people might not expect it, is that our culture is very mixed, because we have people from, you know, all over the world. You know, in the hallways, we speak English in class, but, you know, people are speaking different languages to their friends and things like that. But our culture, in terms of movies people watch and books they read and video games, is very American. And a lot of that has to do with the fact of that they have such fast internet in Tokyo that anybody can, you know, jump on. And if they have, you know, a VPN or some way of getting access to U.S. content, I mean, they are. And so being connected, you know, at home and online is not just, you know, for fun. It's really the only way sometimes to stay on top of the culture out there. And so you see at our school that a lot of kids, they are very savvy in knowing how to get access to different content and different media and movies and things like that, because you don't get it if you just turn on the TV in your house.
So So I guess the elephant in the room for me is, how did you end up, a guy from Minnesota, how did you end up in Japan?
That is a great question. I'll give you the shortest version, which is I was a computer science major in college. And while I was studying, I was also a TA for my sophomore through senior year, and I really enjoyed teaching. And so my senior year, I was watching all my friends going and interviewing at jobs and cubicle jobs, or sorry, banks and cubicle jobs, and looking at that thinking, I enjoy computer science. I don't think I would enjoy those jobs. And so I was sort of like, well, what should I do? And this is pre sort of boom. You know, there weren't the Googles out there to really apply at the time. And so I happened to see a poster for hey, do you want to go and teach in Japan? And I thought, you know what, why not? I'll just take a year or so and, you know, think things through. I like to teach. This is, you know, it's a program offered to the Japanese government called JET that, mm-hmm. you know, you can trust that it's going to be legit. And so I did. And I came to Japan and taught for 3 years and really enjoyed it. And after that, my wife and I sort of bounced around and we decided, you know, let's go back to Japan. We really enjoyed being there. And so we moved back, and we've been here at the school for 10 years now. So,
wow, that's kind of crazy. So, how long when you left? How long were you away?
We left Japan in about 2003, and we came back about 2006. So about 3 years, and in there, I mean, I actually worked for McDougall Attell, the textbook company, briefly. And then I also went to film school for a while, and then I actually worked on some small films. And you can actually, I actually do have an IMDb page with like one credit, so you can look me up if you want. But anyway, yeah, I kind of bounced around and sort of explored some different options before we decided, you know, let's go back to Japan. Let's get back, you know, into sort of education and technology, which is sort of where my two passions are, and here I am.
So you are a boom operator in The Horrible Flowers in 2006.
That is right. I held the microphone for that film, and it was a film just big enough to give me a credit on IMDb, but not quite big enough for anybody to have actually seen it.
Yeah, well, yeah, I'll put a link to that in the show notes. Like, you're our first guest that's ever had an IMDb page. It's pretty impressive. So happy that you came on. I'm glad we got to connect. Like, where, if our listeners want to learn more about you, about your school, where can they find out about that? And I know I'll put a link to your school's website in the show notes as well. But, you know, where can, if folks want to learn more about you and what you do, where can they learn more about you?
I have a website, joshraub.net. That's joshraub.net. It's very infrequently updated, but it does have a link to a couple of presentations and things I've done on sort of like games and programming and things like that in education. But the best place is probably just Twitter. My handle is x5josh5x.
Well, I just followed you on there.
Awesome.
So, yeah, if you have good SEO on your name, because like your blog was like the fourth one down. So
yes,
you're getting there. You're getting there. It's like, I always want to be the most famous person with my name.
Well, you know, when I was a kid, nobody was named Josh, you know, it was a very rare name and it has become more popular. And so it used to be great. I would be the only Josh around, and now there are Joshes all over the place. And so it's like, oh no, I'm, you know, in the past, if the internet would have been around and you searched, it'd be like, I'm the one. And it's not the case anymore.
What do you, you know, Japan was kind of in the news yesterday with the partnership of Apple, the IBM, and the Japan Post Group delivering iPads to elderly in Japan. Like, what do you make about that?
It's okay. So this is a very interesting problem in Japan, in that it's an aging population, which doesn't, I mean, you know, it's always funny when you talk about Japan, you always think about, you say it's an aging population, and I imagine every listener imagining just a streets filled with old people, but it's, that's not the case. There are lots of young people here, but if you look at the sort of the big picture, the population is aging, and with a growing aging population, you know, people, you know, they may live with their parents, but it's just like in the States, there are people in old folks' homes, there's people in hospitals in different situations. And so it has been one of those things where Japan has sort of said, how do we help support these elderly people that may not live close to a family member or may not, you know, live in an old folks' home? They may be living on their own or trying to. And so they set up this program through the Japan Post. I can't remember how many years back, but the program is basically, they because they're delivering mail and driving around, they will actually check on old people, keep an eye on them, make sure, you know, they'll not just deliver the mail, but say, how you doing? Are you okay? And just check in on them. So for family members who maybe worry about somebody living on their own or that sort of situation. And so that program has been in place. And this new one is, or this new part of that program is to say, let's also try to get these people connected, you know, get them iPads, get them, you know, connected to their family that way. And I think what's amazing and something that you see a lot at my school with teachers as well, because our teachers are, you know, they're from 13 different countries, you know, all over the world and have family all over the world. And iPad has been a game changer with FaceTime and messages. And it's so easy to use for, you know, those grandparent conversations that's really what they're looking at here is you get these people connected with an iPad, which, you know, a few custom apps from IBM on there that will make it much, much easier for them to understand than saying trying to use a cell phone or a regular computer and get them connected in a way that they just aren't connected to, say, their family or friends anymore.
Yeah, in some ways, it's like you don't have to digitally or physically go check on people. You can just be like, you know, hey, if you, I haven't seen you playing Candy Crush. Are you okay?
Yeah. I'm waiting for your letterpress move. What's going on here?
Yeah, it's like, do I need to come check on you? Yeah, that's funny. No, that was exciting news. And apparently, like, Japan Post is quite a big company, and their revenues are very, very large.
It's amazing. They are not just a post office. They have a bank kind of component, a sort of retirement savings component, and they're more than just a post office. And so when I tell that to people, sometimes they're like, "Wait, what? They don't just deliver the mail?" And it's like, "No, they have a lot of different services. They're pretty huge."
Yeah, it was funny. I was dealing with our postal company yesterday, and so I think I mentioned on the show that I switched to iPhone 6 Plus, and so
you and everybody else.
Yeah,
right?
No, it's like the big
Mike
thing.
Mike was right.
Well, it's what I told you know, when I haven't mentioned on the show, but Mike and I actually met a few weeks ago at the Atlanta Pen Show. So there's a couple of listeners that were down there, and so it was fun getting to like meet people in real life, especially Mike, because he was over for the recording of the Pen Show. Because that's the thing, it's funny, you know, the Brad Dowdy, who runs the Pen Addict website and podcast, and then knock.co, I've known Brad for years because we have a mutual friend, Aaron Mankey, like, and he does the Homework podcast over on 5x5.
Oh, right. Yeah.
And he does the Lore podcast, which is like booming right now. And it's like number 30 on the entire iTunes list right now. Like it's a really interesting podcast about, like, basically it's like telling ghost stories. It's fantastic. And he's like becoming popular off it. And Aaron's been reading his writing for years, very good friend of mine. So he comes down once a year to Boston to visit his in-laws. So for the past few years, I've always gone down to Atlanta and we've met up for at least dinner. And then Brad Dowdy, who lives in Macon, and he'll come up and meet us for dinner and things like that. So I've known Brad for years, but in the Penn circle, like, Brad is legendary. Like, it would be like you knowing John Gruber, like kind right. of one of the most famous Apple people. Like, Brad, it's like when I tell people from Chattanooga that I know Brad Dowdy and I've met Brad Dowdy, like, you would think he was a celebrity.
Right. And when I listened to, you know, the Upgrade with Jason Snell, and it was so funny when he and Stephen Hackett were talking about, you know, just reporting on, you know, when Stephen went to the conference with Mike, and they were just like, we have no idea anything about these pins or the subculture, but man, is it fun to listen to people that are just so into something. But we're just clueless. They're using words we don't understand. And there's like, you know, Brad's like this superstar, and they're like, what? Like, we had no clue.
Yeah, because to me, I mean, Brad is such a great guy. Like, he's so, so nice and just a regular guy. But among the pin circle, he's like, he's it. Well, and that's what's funny. We were at his company had a was throwing a party Friday night, and that's where I drove down and met Mike. Aaron and I had met up for dinner, and then we were going to that party, and Stephen Hackett was there, and then Another guy that I work with over at the Suite Setup is, his name is Jeff Abbott, and he's at draftevolution.com, and he does all of our kind of like editing and things like that. And so we had to meet up with all these people I'd never met before. And like, you know, and we were talking, it's like these, people are independents. And I say that, like, I'm not making fun, but right. I don't get it. And they're having these, they have these pens that they're spending hundreds of dollars for. And in my mind, it's like, it's just a pen. Like, what's the difference? But, you know, of course, I love a good G2. And Brad's always joked with me that I'm just thankful that you actually pay for pens. That's his joke right, to me. It's like right. You're buying something. You're not using a hotel pen or a gas station pen. You actually buy a pen. But it's probably like when pen people hear us talking about switching to iPhone 6 Pluses, they probably right. say the same thing to us. Like, yeah, you know, it's just a phone. Like, right. And so, like, I recognize that, like, the pen culture is huge and it's a thing. I'm not in it, but, like, I can at least recognize that it exists. And, like, I'm thankful that kind of thing can exist because of the internet. Like, the fact that Brad Dowdy and Mike Hurley can have a podcast about pens and it can be very, very successful, that makes me happy for the internet, because that wouldn't exist without the internet.
Exactly. Well, and that's, you know, looking at me here, being able to chat with you from Japan about, you know, we have these two different schools, but in a sense, they're very, very similar, despite the fact being half the world away.
Oh, yeah. And it's like, I show people at work my Apple Watch, and I'm like, you know, Fraser is like really the only person that I chat with daily that's got one. And so we're always sending like heartbeats back and forth that basically show people. I assume every time he sends me a heartbeat or a drawing that he's showing it to somebody. And I'm like, y'all realize he's in Scotland, right? And this is like real time. I mean, that's, you know, it kind of blows my mind. But it was fun. It was fun meeting up with Mike. Mike's a super nice guy. And so I guess I forgot to finish that story, but I told him like, hey, I'm switching to a 6 Plus next week. He just basically said, Mike was all right. You know, of course, Mike is such a nice guy. And I'm so, you know, he's one of those like success stories on the internet that you're just like, you know, that's someone you can look to and say, he was just like a regular guy and he started doing what he enjoyed. And now it's his full-time job. Like, you're just thankful that A, that he had the courage to do that, and B, our world is structured in a way where he can be successful in that. And that's why, like, I tell people, like, we, for the first time, like, this generation is coming to now. This is the first generation of kids. We can say to them, you can do whatever you want to do. Like, you know, they said that to us, but you just couldn't. Like, there wasn't. The internet has enabled so many things. Like, you know, when you're coming up, if you wanted to be in sports broadcasting, like, hope you get on ESPN, or hope you get on a major news network, or, you know, if you want to get kind of, you know, to be a decent sized market. But now it's like, you know, you want to be a sports broadcaster, have a sports podcast, make it big.
Yeah.
And you can do that now.
And you look at Mike in particular, we're on the Mike vertical right now, but it is, you know, going back to sort of digital citizenship and parents' concerns with kids, one of the concerns they have is, my kid's living his life in public, he's connected, I'm worried, you know, my daughter is out there connected with people on the internet. But then you look at somebody like Mike and you're like, yeah, and that's why he got where he is. I mean, you know, I've followed him, you know, from the 70 decibels days, and a lot of people have, and they've been able to sort of follow, you know, his story through the different networks, through quitting his day job, and support him and encourage him and really root for him. And you can only do that if you are living with some sort of connection to people through the internet. And so you look at those sorts of stories when you talk to parents and students and just say, like, there is that side that people focus on in the media and people are concerned about the internet, but man, there is this whole other capability that's added because we are connected with the internet as well.
On the most recent analog podcast that Mike does with Casey Liss, he was talking about basically online dating. And he was telling a story about how
I haven't listened to this one yet.
Yeah, it's actually really, really good. I love analog podcasts. Casey is very nice guy. Another success story. Like, I had been friends with Casey for years back before. Certainly, he was on the Excellent Tech podcast, and like now it's like it's gone from like Casey. And Casey just like a guy like me and you, and then like he gets on a podcast with his buddies, and like now he's kind of an internet celebrity, and he's just like, he's fantastic at podcasting. He's like a super all around nice guy. And it's another one of those, like, you know, if you're good at something, like, you can make a go at this. And like Casey's just very interesting. But again, like, it's not like he was famous before that. He just kind of like he does good work at it. And so they were talking about the, you know, the analog podcast is about basically talking about the offline aspect of our digital worlds. And so Mike was saying that he was doing online dating. I guess it was like a year and a half ago. He was trying to meet some new people. He had broken up with his girlfriend. And he said, you know, I made the mistake of putting my full name on my profile instead of like, you know, Mike H. He right. said, so she was very aware of like who I was beforehand. So I was like, oh, that's interesting that he's an internet celebrity and this girl can know everything. She can listen to him talk for hours and hours before their first date.
Right. Well, and I have to say, even just talking to you right now, it is so sort of comfortable because I've heard you have these sorts of conversations for like 100 and something episodes with Frasier. So, you know, it's like, I don't know you personally, but I know how you talk. I know the types of things you talk about, which is, I'm telling you, it's still kind of surreal.
Well, it's funny. You can like, you could listen to any podcast enough and like, you can pretty much like, you get to know them so well, you can pretty much almost can guess how they're going to react to any certain topic. Cause you understand like what, you know, their motivation and it was funny when I was meeting Mike, it's like, hey, talk faster. I'm not used to you talking so slow. Like you're talking in a normal voice. Like, can you speed up a little bit? Do we have smart speed in real life? The Overcast feature. So yeah, it was fun. It was fun meeting Mike. He's like such a nice guy, but, I totally got sidetracked. I didn't finish my story about the USPS. So, I was telling that to Mike and a friend of mine, Bill Nalen, who we were switching phones. I was sending him mine, and he was sending me his. Both had the same phone, so we were just gonna swap. And he sent me his phone last week, and he said, just keep it for a week, make sure you like it. So I did it. And I said, hey, I'm sending you this, and I sent him a DM and. Hey, I'm going to send this to you. You sent me his address. I said, do you care if I send it to Postal Service instead of UPS? Because like the Postal Service is closer to my house or closer to my office than UPS. He's like, oh, that's fine. So I insured it for like, you know, $900. And it's supposed to be your signature required. So it's supposed to be there on Wednesday. Doesn't show up. Oh, okay. Still says like deliver. You know, still says like, you know, delivering soon. So on Thursday, like I get a notification that says it's delivered. I use the app called Deliveries. It sends it to my watch. Actually, it says like, you know, package iPhone, Bill's iPhone delivers. Like, that's great. Send him a DM. Like, hey, just want to make sure you got it. He says no.
Oh no.
It's like, wait a minute. And so like on the thing, it says Littleton, Colorado, but that's not where I shipped it. And of course, he confirms it's basically the same thing. So I'm like, what's odd? He's like, then he sends me back. He's like, oh, I got it. It was in the mailbox. It was supposed to be signature required. Oh, and like, the guy just like dropped it off. And he said that like their postal guy was like terrible, but it's like, I sent out a package with $900 worth of insurance, and the guy doesn't even get it signed for. Like, how does that even happen?
Yeah, and you know, the guy may be lazy, but man, if he lost that $900 package, you know, he would be in some big trouble.
I cannot handle stuff like that. Where it's like, you had one job, like I paid for a signature on a package that I've estimated the value at $900. Like, you can't get that signed. Like, how hard is that?
Exactly. Yeah.
Anyways, we'll wrap up here. Josh, thanks for coming on the show. And we'll have links to your school's website and your Twitter page and your blog in the show notes. So if you want to connect with Josh and learn more about the school, you definitely want to check out that show notes at outofschool.net. Frasier will be back with us next week. And so hope everybody has a good week. I'm on the web at Chambers Daily and on Twitter at Bradley Chambers. And thanks for listening.